Bethany McLean is a journalist who is contributing editor to Vanity Fair and has written books about Enron, the 2008 financial crisis, and the fracking industry. I talked to her about the role she played in the downfall of Enron and her newest book, Saudi America. I'm here with Bethany McLean. Bethany, thanks so much for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
So I wanted to talk to you about the Enron scandal and your place in the role, or your role in this Enron story sort of begins at the moment at which Enron starts to collapse, and your reporting played a big role in that collapse. I want to talk to you about what that experience was like, but first I think it's important for us to get an idea of how Enron became the corporate crime of the century, as it was later called. So to begin with, Enron was at one point a legitimate company, correct?
It was absolutely a legitimate company, and I would argue it was in some ways a legitimate company up until its collapse. Enron was never it's not quite as fraudulent as most people believe, although there was certainly fraud there.
Okay. So going back to way back to 1989, Jeff Skilling came to Enron from McKinsey, and he basically had the idea of turning natural gas into a commodity. In other words, just focusing on, instead of having physical assets like pipelines, you would buy and sell energy. This was a big turning point in the company. What was the reaction within Enron to that idea? What was the reaction on Wall Street? And what role did this shift in strategy play in their later downfall?
So that's a lot.
Sorry.
The reaction inside the company was some skepticism. Enron had been originally a pipeline company, and so this idea that you could trade natural gas and you didn't have to own any of the physical infrastructure associated with natural gas, instead your business could literally be trading it like we trade stocks and bonds, was a very strange concept. And at the time that Skilling came up with this idea, which he called the gas bank, that wasn't happening yet. Natural gas wasn't a commodity that was sliced and diced into its components parts and trade it. And look, it was a huge innovation. And so one of the things that fascinates me about Enron is this line between innovation and fraud, because Enron unquestionably transformed the natural gas market. The problem at Enron wasn't so much the ideas as it was Enron's desperation to present a picture of smooth and ever-growing earnings rather than really volatile earnings and losses in some of the new businesses they were starting. So what they did was engage in all sorts of complicated financial transactions, some fraudulent, some not, but all of which misrepresented Enron's financial picture in order to create this earnings picture that was much more pleasing to Wall Street than what their business would have been anyway. But that doesn't mean some of the core ideas at Enron weren't actually incredibly innovative and even brilliant.
Interesting. So the idea of the gas bank, was that something that played a role in the volatility, though?
Absolutely, because any trading business is volatile. You can't predict the earnings to a penny of a trading business the way you can of a business that sells widgets. And Wall Street historically, traditionally, still today, has valued businesses that can produce predictable earnings far more than businesses that produce volatile earnings. It's one reason why investment banks, when they were standalone investment banks, used to trade at low multiples, because they're volatile businesses. They depend on market conditions. And because Enron didn't want the kind of stock price multiple associated with a volatile business, Skilling pretended that this business of trading natural gas was very predictable, that it was based on the amount of volume that Enron did. And that couldn't have been further than the truth. And so there was a fundamental misrepresentation at the heart of things, which I don't think you could argue was solely responsible for Enron's collapse, but was certainly a factor in it.
Okay. And let's talk about Jeff Skilling a little bit, because so much of the story of Enron, and particularly with your book, The Smartest Guys in the Room, is about the characters behind the scandal. And Jeff Skilling was kind of like a former nerd who became this like macho, risk-taking juggernaut. Could you describe him a little bit? What did he bring to the culture of Enron?
So he, as you mentioned, was an ex-McKinsey guy. People used to say about him that famous line, which says volumes about somebody, sometimes wrong, never in doubt. He was very sure of himself. People also described him as incandescently brilliant because he had this ability to take these complex ideas and just present them in these sparkling, simple ways that would just capture people's imagination. He was a guy who would often say about people that he liked guys with spikes. And what he meant by that was that he liked people with very pronounced talents and skills, even if those had came with some difficult aspects to them. And so he surrounded himself with people who were flawed, but could deliver the sort of things that he wanted them to deliver. He was a guy who was really good at something I like to think of as intellectual intimidation, so that even people who didn't understand Enron's business would pretend that they understood it because they didn't want to face Skilling's wrath or risk his disrespect for their lack of understanding. And that allowed Enron to get away with having a business that nobody understood.
Interesting. And one of the things that was kind of shocking was this concept of the PRC, the performance review, that every 6 months they basically rated everyone in the company and cut out the bottom 15% of performers, no matter how good they were. Within Enron, was there a lot of camaraderie among employees or the kinds of people that tended to thrive in that environment? Were they mostly just the people with spikes?
There were a lot of people with spikes. Yeah. I think it depends on what business. And you talk to some of the people who worked in trading at Enron, and they'll still describe it as the best time of their lives, an incredibly innovative time where they were free to do, to pursue ideas that they thought were going to make sense. So if you had the right kind of macho personality for that environment, it worked really well. If you didn't, then it didn't work as well.
Interesting. And around this time, energy markets, particularly in places like California, started to deregulate. Why was this good news for Enron? And did they use these new freedoms responsibly?
Well, in a word, no. So it was good news for Enron on two fronts. Their trading business, which they called the wholesale business, which was trading natural gas mainly, could have more opportunity to profit in deregulated gas markets and deregulated energy markets than in regulated ones. Enron also had a business called Enron Energy Services, which would enter into these long-term contracts with, say, Walmart to supply all of Walmart's energy needs. And that business also its existence was predicated on the deregulation of energy markets. So Enron, in many ways, is the ultimate example of the stupidity of short-term thinking, because when California deregulated its energy market and the horrible summer that followed of rolling blackouts because of power shortages, Enron, it later turned out, contributed to that through outright fraudulent games that they played in order to take energy out of places in California that needed it in order to increase the prices they could get. And you say, in a short-term sense, in a purely short-term capitalistic sense, of course they'd do that. They manipulated the rules that the system set up in order to make money for themselves. But the problem is their long-term interest lay in helping California succeed, right? Because right. After what happened in California, there weren't many other states that were going to say, oh, good, look at that, let's deregulate too. So in the end, it betrays the real kind of stupidity at the heart of Enron's very short-term oriented goals.
So it seems at this point, though, from the outside, you might call them short-term thinking or greedy, but putting aside the moral judgment, they seemed as a business to be doing well on the outside. But in fact, on the inside, they had a lot of debt. Their cash flow was minimal or it was volatile. And the guy who helped cover their tracks, one of the guys, was Andy Fastow. Could you tell us a little bit about him? What was his role at Enron?
So Andy Fastow was another guy with spikes who Jeff Skilling hired for his expertise in securitization. And Andy became Enron's CFO. And in many ways, his presence, I think, helped tip Enron over the line from aggressive accounting into fraud, because he was willing to do the things that arguably Skilling wanted him to do in order to make the numbers. You could also, though, look at Andy is the guy who kept Enron in business for as long as it stayed in business, because he was able to engage in so much financial engineering that Enron was able to present this completely misleading picture of economic reality. And that helped keep its stock price up for years after it otherwise would have fallen off a cliff.
And how did, I know you use things called like special purpose entities, which are basically just shell companies, correct?
Right. There were a bunch of different ways that Enron manipulated all of its financial statistics, including its cash flow. One way was by using these special purpose entities that were outside partnerships run by FastOut to sell assets to those special purpose entities at the end of a quarter so that Enron could book the gain. And that actually was technically legal under accounting rules. What wasn't legal is that there would often be these handshake deals on the side that would enable the special purpose entity to sell the asset back to Enron at some point in order to make money for the special purpose entity. So that made it illegal under accounting rules. There were other ways in which Enron would manipulate cash flow by doing these things called prepays, where they would sell big quantities of natural gas, say forward, and take a loan in exchange for that, and book that loan as operating cash flow rather than as a loan. So there were, and then a third way Enron would manipulate earnings was by abusing mark-to-market accounting, when mark-to-market accounting depends on future estimates of profitability. So if you're willing to be, if there's no recorded market for things and you're willing to be aggressive in your assumptions, you can basically create earnings out of thin air.
Interesting. So let's say if you're just like a trader at Enron, you have no idea this is going on.
Well, you do and you don't. It's interesting. I remember talking to a trader after the bankruptcy, and he said, you know, what's really interesting is that nobody cared how much cash we had to spend in order to generate reported earnings. The whole name of the game was generating reported earnings. And if you had to spend $10 million in cash in order to book $5 million in earnings, well, you'd do that all day long. And he said, when I look back, I realized that an entire company whose incentive structure was screwed, that was skewed that way, was going to end in calamity, right? So there were clues. But I think being able to see the big picture required being able to take yourself out of the moment and step back and look at the whole thing. And very few of us are ever capable of that, particularly when our livelihood is at stake.
Right. Were people like Skilling or Andy Fastow, were they thinking to themselves that at some point we're going to turn it around? We're going to get to a point where we don't have to engage in fraud in order to boost our business?
Yeah. And any story I've learned, in any story of business gone wrong, white collar fraud, whatever, whichever one it is, there's always a hefty amount of self-delusion and rationalization, usually in the form of, this is what our investors would want us to do because they don't want us to miss earnings and see the stock price plummet. So we're just going to be a little bit aggressive in this quarter, and then this new business that we've started is going to start working and we're not going to have to do that anymore. So there's always this belief that you're just bridging a temporary hole and that the new businesses that you've created are going to kick in, or the problems are going to go away.
And then in 2001, March of 2001, you wrote an article questioning Enron's business practices called "Is Enron Overpriced?"
Biggest time on history, right?
Yeah. what made you want to cover Enron in the first place?
So I developed, I'd worked on Wall Street right out of college. And so I was pretty handy with financial statements. And I developed a lot of sources who were short sellers, because I had learned that if you only got information from the Wall Street buy machine, you were often going to be misleading your readers because you were only going to be getting the positive side of the story. And so a well-known short seller named Jim Chanos called at one point, or I called him and asked what he was thinking about. And he said, you should take a look at Enron. We can't figure out how it makes money. Let me know if you can figure it out. And so I tried. Yeah. And that was what happened.
You talked about how you called Jeff Skilling. What did you ask him, and what was that call like?
Well, so before, as a journalist, before you write anything about anybody, you always have to give them time to respond and the opportunity to respond. So I called Enron, and I actually really thought that they were going to be, that their response was going to be something like, yeah, whatever. People criticize us for this. Here are the answers. Here's why this criticism is completely wrong. Yeah, write whatever you want. Everybody knows it's ridiculous. And instead, they just went apeshit, basically, and they Jeff Skilling went crazy on the phone and said that people who raised these questions were just trying to throw rocks at the company, and that I was not ethical because I hadn't done enough homework to be writing a critical piece, mm-hmm. and if I really understood the company, I would not be raising these mm-hmm. type of questions. They had Ken Lay, then the chairman, call my editor. They flew people up to New York. I mean, it was this whole onslaught. Wow. In retrospect, it seems clear that it was a sign that something was badly wrong. But at the time, I was just terrified and scared to death I was wrong. So
you were wondering, okay, maybe I there's something I'm not seeing here. Do you think if they had handled it a little bit more coolly, they would have been able to keep their cover for a couple more years?
I don't know. I don't know because the numbers were the numbers in their financial statement. So it wasn't so much guesswork as it was like something doesn't make sense here. And these numbers are problematic in ways that the market isn't reflecting. I've never thought that I broke the story, because to me, breaking the story means really getting inside it and exposing at the core of what's wrong. And my story was more of kind of lucky, insightful analysis saying this doesn't make sense. But it wasn't the depth of the problems at Enron. It was so much deeper than my story really, really explained. But I've never actually thought that my piece caused the collapse of Enron either. I think it picked up on skepticism that was brewing in the market, not just among short sellers, but increasingly among long-only investors as well, about what exactly this company was up to. And that's partly because of the collapse of the first internet bubble in the spring of 2000. Enron had this business called Enron Broadband, which was supposed to be the next big thing. And even as the broadband industry was obviously cratering after the collapse of the dot-com bubble, Enron kept saying, and Jeff Skilling kept saying in conference calls, everything's great with our business. And people were, there was increasingly just a cognitive disconnect there. I don't think my story changed the course of history. I think what happened to Enron would have happened regardless of my story. I think it would have been bankrupt approximately at the same time that it was.
Interesting.
There's no way to know that, right? That's just
right.
That's just what I believe, but I don't know.
Yeah, I mean, it seems like if you're running a fraud, at a certain point, it's going to collapse in on itself.
But when that point is the thing that people that's the risk in being a short seller, right? Because you could be totally right that it's a fraud, and there were a lot of people, actually, a lot of short sellers who got totally run over by the big gains in Enron stock in 99 and 2000, because the problems were there already. And mm-hmm. people who were short the stock identified them. They were just too early.
Oh, wow. Man, that would be a horrible feeling.
Wouldn't it? Imagine.
Yeah. Basically on that same point, what's amazing to me about this whole story is not really that the fraud got uncovered, because it usually does, but that it didn't get uncovered sooner. Do you have any insight into why this was not picked up on earlier? There are plenty of really smart people on Wall Street who should have been able to see this, right?
Yeah, well, I think a couple of things about that. So I think one, for all that everybody talks about the widespread availability of information, it's actually not true. Information, particularly the information you most need to know, travels in very small closed loops. So despite the fact that there was a cadre of skeptics on Wall Street about Enron, that skepticism didn't make it into the mainstream discourse at all. The information traveled in completely separate circles. I think also Enron was really, really good at playing the game of meeting or beating the earnings earnings expectations that Wall Street analysts had. And there were and are a lot of investors who don't want to do their homework and just want a company that will meet or beat earnings expectations and don't want to look any deeper than that. And when a company becomes so expert at delivering exactly what investors want to see, they can attain this cult-like status where people won't question the set of beliefs surrounding them. And then I think lastly, it was the way that this quality of intellectual intimidation that Jeff Skilling had, that he was able to convince everybody that he and the rest of the Enron team literally were the smartest guys in the room. And so even people who knew they didn't quite understand the business thought, well, these guys are so smart. They just understand something I don't understand and I don't have to worry about it because they're so smart. And so I think that was another factor in it, but it's fascinating, right? Because the problems that ultimately brought Enron down, Andy Fastow's games, the existence of these partnerships, the lack of cash flow, they were right there in the financial statements, not clearly exposed, but you know, but it was there. People just didn't want to see it.
Do you see any parallels then between the collapse of Enron and the collapse of the mortgage business in 2008, the idea that there were some innovations to begin with, but then it sort of got out of control and people just trusted the smart guys to know what they were doing?
Yeah. Well, I do. I mean, it's the same old principle at the end of it, right? If it seems too good to be true, maybe it is.
Yeah.
And so in Enron's case, if it seemed too good to be true that a Houston-based energy company could deliver exactly the earnings that investors wanted to see quarter after quarter and make everybody rich. And in the case of subprime mortgages, it was that you could give mortgages to people who didn't have a chance of paying them back. And somehow the people in the system were all going to be just fine and dandy. And you look at them after the collapse and you say, how could we ever have believed that? But you have to remember that everybody did believe it in the moment. So I think that's the biggest parallel to me. That willingness to believe in the thing that after the fact is so obviously going to seem insane that you ever believed it.
Do you think then that there are any lessons here for business people or journalists? I mean, have we as a society or as our politics really integrated what you see to be the lessons of Enron?
I don't think so. No, I don't think we'll ever learn them. And in some ways, maybe we don't want to learn them because part of American business in particular is optimism. And if you are so focused on the lessons and the risks, then some of the very real innovations that move our world forward won't happen either. And then if everybody did really focus on always doing the right thing and carefully monitoring all this stuff, I wouldn't have anything to write about. So I don't really want to either, speaking selfishly. But no, seriously, I think it's human nature and it's the nature of bubbles that people start to believe in things that are going to seem crazy after the fact. And it happens. It's happened throughout time immemorial, right? From the tulip bubble through Enron through to Theranos most recently, or maybe even Tesla to invoke another controversial name. It's the way the world works. I don't think it's ever going to be fixed, and I'm not sure you ever want it to be entirely fixed.
Do you think Tesla's a bubble?
I do.
Interesting.
Doesn't mean Elon Musk isn't a genius, and it doesn't mean that he hasn't changed the world. But I think that there are some fundamental problems at Tesla that perhaps the bulls don't want to wrestle with.
Interesting. Well, speaking of things for you to write about, you have a new book out called Saudi America. Could you tell us a little bit about that?
So in a way, it's related to Enron and the financial crisis. Someone actually joked, I did another little book on Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac called Shaky Ground, and someone joked recently that every one of my books should be called Shaky Ground. It's kind of true. But Saudi America is essentially, it's about fracking, but it's about the fact that the fracking industry is very financially unstable. It doesn't make money. And so it's about the existence of this industry and the way in which the huge quantities of natural gas and oil being produced in the United States as a result of fracking are reshaping geopolitics. And yet at its core, the industry is incredibly unstable because of the lack of cash flow. So that's what the book attempts to wrestle with. I'd be lying if I said I came up with any solid answers. I learned the energy landscape is littered with the wreckage of those who have dared to predict the future. So I'm definitely cautious about my ability to do that. But I find it fascinating because it is this thing that is changing the world, and yet the financial bulwark isn't there.
That's interesting, because most of the criticisms that I've heard about fracking have been environmental, but not that my impression, and I don't know a ton about the business of it, my impression was that it was something that sort of saved the oil industry, or was thought to be something that could produce a huge amount of shale where we thought that we were running out of ways to dig it.
It's true. It did. It's what has almost single-handedly taken America from fears of natural gas and oil shortages into, once again in this fall, being the world's number one producer of crude oil, ahead of Saudi Arabia and Russia for the first time since the 1970s. That's entirely due to the fracking boom. And yet the industry doesn't make money. So if Wall Street were to stop being willing to fund it, and Wall Street, but harkening back to subprime mortgages, will fund all sorts of things that don't make sense in the end. But if Wall Street stops being willing to fund it, there's an open question about what would happen to the quantities of natural gas and oil that we're producing.
Oh, wow. Do you think that?
In other words, the business is dependent on Wall Street largesse, on these huge capital flows.
Interesting. And so you say you don't come to any necessarily conclusions about where this is going to go, but do you think that that's definitely a possibility on the horizon?
I do. I think it's an open question. If investors stop being willing to fund this, and the reasons why they are have to do with lots of things in the wake of the financial crisis, from the Federal Reserve's record low interest rates to the desperate desire on the part of investors to find growth anywhere, somewhere. If investors stopped funding this and companies had to exist within the cash flow that they produce, it's an open question as to how much oil and gas the U.S. would actually be producing. And I just think as we get into this incredible boosterism with President Trump and his administration talking not just about American energy independence, but American energy dominance, it's worth realizing how fragile the industry actually is.
Wow.
Doesn't mean it's going to crater. Doesn't mean it's going to cause a financial crisis, but it's fragile.
Interesting. That's the first time I've heard that. And I hope it doesn't. Even though I'm not a big fan of fracking, I guess I hope it doesn't collapse and crash the economy.
I know. So it's there was already, there's a fascinating piece in the New York Times back in the fall about how there was a mini recession in parts of the country in 2015. And then part of that was there was a collapse in fracking when Saudi Arabia wouldn't cut production and the price of oil plummeted, and like 150 American E&P companies went out of business during that period. And this piece in the New York Times highlighted that we don't really understand how much fracking has changed the economy, because being an energy exporter is very, very different than being an energy importer in terms of how your economy moves. You know, in the one case, if you're an importer, low prices are really good for you. If you're an exporter, then low prices are not as good for you. And so we're still living through the impact of that change.
Interesting. Well, if you wrote it, it's probably really good. So I definitely recommend people check it out.
That's nice of you. Thank you.
Bethany McLean, it was great talking to you. Thank you so much for your time.
You too. Thank you for having me.
Thank you to Bethany McLean, and thank you for listening to Dunk Tank. See you next time.